This is East End Inc. Tonight's program features author Philip Hoare presenting his book, Albert and the Whale, Albrecht Dürer and How Art Imagines Our World. Philip Hoare is professor of creative writing at the University of Southampton, England.
Like many people, I think Dürer is there in the back of my head. He is such a powerful artist. His images are truly iconic, a much overused word, but they really are, because they register in the mind. Even if you don't know who Dürer is, I think you would probably have seen a Dürer image, from the praying hands to the rhinoceros to the twitching hair. These wonderful images of the natural world, which is really why he is most extraordinary, I think, as a Renaissance artist. Both he and Leonardo, who really paid attention to the natural world in a new scientific manner, in a way. And that's what really drew me to him. In fact, it was going to the Boston Museum of Modern Arts, Fine Arts, and seeing an exhibition of Dürer's prints there back in 2004, I think it was. And I was in the depths of my whale obsession. I was in Provincetown, you know, being on the whale watches. I was volunteering on the whale watch boats and becoming pretty obsessive about whales. And I was very caught about this story about Dürer's connection with the whale. So we'll look at that in a minute, but I'm just going to sort of set the scene, really, because I sort of come into Dürer's story in 1520, at which point he really is the most famous artist of the Northern Renaissance, the Northern European Renaissance, north of Italy. He really is the presiding genius. But like many artists, his cash flow is not good. He's always complaining that painting portraits takes up so long and doesn't make you a huge amount of money. He's also dependent on his patrons to a greater or lesser extent. And in 1520, he'd received a bit of a shock to the system in that Maximilian I, the Holy Roman Emperor, had died. And he was really one of the great providers. He was providing Dürer with a pension, a yearly pension. So Dürer is very worried about the future. He was in his 40s now, late 40s, which is relatively old in for that period. He was worried about the future. And the story is that in July 1520, he leaves his hometown of Nuremberg to go to the Low Countries, which are part of the Holy Roman Empire, to lobby the new emperor, who's Maximilian's nephew, young man, he's only 18 years old, Charles, about to become Charles V, and who's about to be crowned emperor in the Low Countries. But I was coming towards the end of writing my book, and I was going with that story, and I started looking a little bit closer at some letters, recently discovered letters, from one of the very wealthy merchant families that Dürer knew and who were his patrons. And these letters clearly showed that the reason why Dürer left Nuremberg in July in 1520 wasn't because he was going to lobby Charles V. It was because the plague had hit Nuremberg in a new and really virulent wave. And an emergency administration had been put in place by the civic authorities. And all of Dürer's friends, i.e. the wealthy merchants, the princes, the dukes, were fleeing the town. And they were going west to the coast, to the healthy sea air of what we now know as the Netherlands, and was then generically the Low Countries. And so Dürer leaves Nuremberg for what will be a year-long journey. And the reason why I can tell you so much about Nuremberg is because, almost uniquely, of an artist of his time, he kept a very detailed journal for that year of his journey from Nuremberg through to Antwerp. And it took a long time, 2 weeks to get there, traveling partly by river, by the Rhine and the Maas, partly by horse, having to produce his passport at various places, which he'd been given by the Prince Bishop of Bamberg. He was another one of his patrons. And he arrives in Antwerp, and it's quite funny because his journal's full of all the accounting of his journey. He tells you what he pays for his socks, what he pays for his wine, and how he barters with Prince for other favors or little curiosities he's picking up along the way. He's almost childish in his desire for these wondrous objects, a shark's fin, a living monkey, a parrot, bits of coral, ambergris. He's a real collector in that tradition of the cabinet of curiosities, the Wunderkammer. And he's shipping these things back to Nuremberg as he goes. It's quite remarkable. So he gets to Antwerp, and Antwerp, he's in seventh heaven because Antwerp is the great trading port of Europe, and it's a great diverse place. It's has a sizable population of people of color, surprisingly enough. It's the place where a lot of his pigments are coming in, ultramarine, dragon's blood. Of course, it's not dragon's blood, it's a kind of mineral, but so it's a great place to be an artist. And for a lot of his life, since he returned from his first visit to Italy, where he said to his friend Willibald Pirckheimer, he said, here I am treated like a lord. Back home, I'm a parasite. Because he felt that the profession of artist was not really much better than an artisan, a craftsman. And that rankled with him. He felt he was a gentleman, not an artisan. But in Antwerp, he goes to a banquet thrown for him, and everyone stands up and applauds him as he walks in. You know, he's getting the kudos that he doesn't get at home. He's established in Antwerp, and he is, it must be said, a great drinker and a great gambler. And all these wealthy people have turned up in Antwerp, and they're kind of in this mood of having escaped the Black Death, the plague, which is a predominant preoccupation of the age, we know. But they're in this sort of holiday mood. And he hears on the grapevine, as it were, that a whale has been stranded on the coast of Zeeland. And Zeeland is that great fractured part of the Netherlands, which is almost indiscernible from the sea. It's part sea, part land. It's below sea level, most of it. And it was much more fractured then. There wasn't the kind of reclamation of land which has since been accomplished in the Netherlands. So it was a rather strange place. And this whale had been stranded off the coast there, or on the coast. And the stories he was receiving, almost by sort of telegraph, was this prodigious monster. Some of the reports were saying it was a mile long, and that the stink, the miasma that it was creating, was going to poison the whole village, the nearby village. And of course, a stranded whale, a dead whale, had strange elements of augury about them, of ill omen, but also of good omen sometimes too, because of course the meat of a whale, the teeth of a whale, the bones of a whale were valuable things. So Jura, who, as we know, is a great depictor of the natural world and has had a really great success with his image of a rhinoceros. And I think he's in his head. And this is what I realized when I looked at his woodcuts in the Boston gallery. I think he had in his head this was going to be a really stupendous bestseller. And the thing about Jura is that he got round that notion of the economically inexpedient way of earning money, of painting these portraits, which, I mean, the paint alone was very expensive. Ultramarine was more expensive than gold. So it was a very expensive and time-consuming process. Durer had got round that by the great expedient of printing his own work. And of course, Nuremberg at this point was, it was like the Silicon Valley of Europe. There were 100 printing presses in the city. It was where the first globes were made, the first accounts of Columbus's adventures in the New World were being published. And indeed, actually, when Durer gets to Antwerp and Brussels, he sees there the first Aztec gold sent over by Cortes on display in Brussels, and it's an intimation of another world. And so all this exotica, which feeds his habit, he is able to recycle these images that he creates of the natural world and of exotic things in his paintings, but also in his drawings, which he then creates as prints. And he's really the first artist to do that in any great measure. He is, by force of that, the first truly international artist, because his prints are going out there, going to Norway, they're coming to England, they're being sold in Vienna, in Venice. In fact, at one point he goes to Venice to try and register his trademark, his copyright, because his prints are being plagiarized. And he actually successfully does that. It's maybe the first instance of an artist registering their copyright. And of course, to do that, he uses his monograph, the great A in the D that he creates, this big A with a D in the middle. And it's a kind of pun because it's the name Durer means door. And so the A is a kind of door with the D inside. And there are other aspects to that, which I'll talk about later. But so he hears about this whale and he decides to set off and go and see it. And he gathers a gang of his drinking mates, and they hire a boat. I think it's a chartered boat. And they sail towards this island where this whale is supposed to have stranded. And as they set off, this is in December, so it's not a good time to go sailing anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, and certainly not in Zeeland at that point, because a great storm breaks out. And in a scene which is kind of evocative of Shakespeare's Tempest, the ship carrying Durer and his friends is thrown into the quayside of Middelburg, which is the kind of capital of Zeeland, the town. And the ship smashes against the quay. Some of the passengers get off, but five people remain, and an offshore wind blows them back out to sea. And it seems that they're doomed. The other passengers are looking on, thinking that's the last they're going to see of Albrecht Durer and the rest of their friends. But Durer, in a great sort of heroic gesture, sort of takes control of the situation and orders the captain what to do. I don't quite know where he got all these water skills from, these sailing skills, but he does. And they come back into shore and they really think they owe their life to Albrecht's bravery. But of course, that same storm has washed the whale away. So the great thing that he came to the island for has been taken away. It's not there. And despite another journey the next day, they go out sailing looking for it. They can't find it. And this great sort of disappointment has a kind of a dark edge to it in a way, because soon after that, when Durer's back in Antwerp, he starts complaining of a strange fever. And we're not sure what this fever is or was, but we do know that part of Zeeland was malarial, and it may well be that he caught malaria. And indeed, it seems to be that fever, which was known as intermittent fever, because as you know, malaria comes and goes, can come and go, that actually took his life 8 years later. So this sense of sort of pulling back from the perspective that we see these things, and also maybe taking in some of the superstitions of the time, that he'd advanced too far. His hubris had taken him in search of something unattainable, you know, the greatest animal on earth. And that maybe he was paying for his hubris in doing so. And there is something about Jura's talent and the way he sees the world that really, for me, imbues his story with a kind of fabulous quality.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to University of Southampton, England, Professor Philip Hoare discussing his book, Albert and the Whale, Albrecht Dürer and How Art Imagines Our World. A portion of this presentation contains photos of Dürer's work. A video of the talk can be downloaded at the calendar of events at caneos.wordpress.com. Search for the link to Caneo's YouTube channel.
This is a section of one of Jura's self-portraits. And to me, it's those eyes that really draw you in, don't they? They're really remarkable. This sense of a man who can see the world in a different way, that he has a kind of modernity about the way he looks at the world. The way he portrays the natural world seems echoed in this gaze. And if you look at his eyes, you see quite a classic touch. I mean, it's a known Renaissance gesture to paint a window reflected in the eyes. And the idea was that that was the window of a man's soul. So it has a direct connection to God, really. But what's really interesting is if you look at his hair, which is possibly one of the most famous images he painted, same windows reflected in the hare's eyes. So there's this sense that he's looking at animals, at the natural world, in an utterly new way. I don't know of any artist who painted animals or plants in this way before Dürer. And the hair is crouched there. The nose is twitching. You can see it so super really, in a way, because of the way that Dürer painted it with a single hair brush, a brush with a single hair. I was lucky enough to see this watercolor in the Albertini Gallery in Vienna. It doesn't travel from there now. It's so fragile. But when it was brought from the stores, I saw it in the archives, and it was sort of came out of a grey box. It almost leapt out of a box like a rabbit out of a hat, and crouched there. And we know, or we think we know, that Dürer's looking down on it, and it's probably the hair is probably crouching on his kitchen floor. In fact, the curator of the Albertina suggested to me that soon after this painting was made, the hare was in the pot for supper, which is rather harsh. But it's that eye that he's treating the eye almost like a human. There's a kind of comparison that he's making here. And then, so when you look at this other very famous painting that Dürer made, this clump of turf, he's gone out into the fields outside the city of Nuremberg and dug up this just arbitrary sod of earth. Just, you know, there's nothing remarkable about this. There's dandelions, grasses, there's a plantain. You can even see the roots of these plants, which we would regard as weeds, perhaps. I don't think anyone had drawn dirt before Dürer. You know, it's almost as though they didn't dare. It's almost as though Dürer was exercising a kind of godlike talent here, that he was portraying the world that God had made. And, you know, looking at that clump of grass, you can feel the summer breeze. You can tell that the dandelions are about to burst open and let fly their seeds and they'll float away on the summer air. It's really difficult to us to imagine why Jura spent so much time on these images. They were never sold. They weren't painted for sale. They may have been exercises. There may have been images which he would show to people in his studio to impress them with his talent. But there's something beyond that. There's his, again, that childlike interest in the world. When he was a boy, he'd read the works of Albertus Magnus, the great medieval monk who had charted the world, who had been to the Baltic to examine whales, who had this really quite scientific approach to the natural world, which Dürer imbued and here reproduced. When you see these things, it's really hard to think that those are 500 years old, those images. If you put those in a gallery today, then no, you know, people would wonder at that age. And then, of course, Dürer famously follows these images with the next slide, please, Catherine. I thought I had a different slide, but it's all right. With an image which is almost inexplicable. It's actually painted on the back of it's only the size of a paperback book, this painting. It's tiny. It's in the National Gallery in the UK, in London. It was the first painting of Dürer's I ever saw. And I was just shocked, because why did he paint this? Yeah, what is the meaning of this? We think it might have been a meteorite that came to Earth in about 1497 in Basel, in Switzerland. But again, it's natural phenomena. It's as though he's painting the Big Bang. There's something really extraordinarily powerful about it. The idea that he's looking into the firmament and representing that. He had many visions. He, at one point, he dreamt of a great deluge hitting the earth, and he woke up with a start and painted that. And he painted this exploding water cloud, which looks to us like a nuclear mushroom cloud, you know. I'm going to read a little bit from the book, a taste of the book. So just a short passage that comes from towards the end. It's not a spoiler, so don't worry, but it's just a little section from when I arrive in Vienna, modern day Vienna. It's hotter than ever. I could have swum here down the river like a dog. I'm drawn on and on, deeper into the continent. I leave the station with its pale walls and decorations and cross the tram lines. Elderly apartments retreat from the heat wave, their tiled halls and iron banisters winding up into endless interiors. Over the street is the campus. To get to the library, I must pass through a concrete hall, more like a car park. The students hurry upstairs as if scared of the dark. Martin appears with a big grey cardboard box. "Where would you like to look at it?" he asks. He's used to an older, grander place. He's younger than me, wears his hair slicked back, shoes with no socks, a concession to the heat. There's a crested ring on his little finger. We descend to the lower floor, which could be a warehouse for shipping out stock. It has no characteristics at all. Laying a box on the table, Martin opens it up. Inside is a Morocco leather folder, its edges ribbed with age. A slender pouch is attached to it, the size and shape of a 1920s cigarette case. Martin unfolds its flaps. They come apart like a flower. Embedded within it is a slab of glass contained in a silver frame. Excuse me. Martin gently eases it out. I keep chatting, reluctant to address the thing there in his hand. I've come hundreds of miles to see it, but now I'm looking anywhere else. He must think me very odd. Unable to avert my eyes any longer, I look down. Caught in the glass, as if in amber, is a long, surprisingly blonde lock of hair. It doesn't look human at all. It might have been snipped from a thoroughbred's mane. It appears to be two colours, a pale straw yellow and a darker mousy brown with a hint of red. It twirls as if alive. A bracelet of bright hair about the bone. My hands hover over it. May I pick it up? Yes, but I must keep it close to its case. I'm holding Jura. He's as heavy as a tooth or a tusk. He doesn't feel safe in my bent fingers. He ought to be in a Baroque chapel, in a monstrance, not in this academic basement. Martin and I talk about what it means. Neither of us is sure. Because I don't speak his first language and he only fitfully speaks mine, and because there's this powerful thing between us, our words are more precise. Actually, Martin says, we're not sure if it's his hair at all. But then, he says, how many true crosses were there? Jura was raised on relics. Now he is one. His hair growing on after he's gone, a floppy lock fallen from the barber's chair, a token for a lost loved one. Locked up like the princess in her crystal coffin, waiting to regenerate. We could make a new Jura from his genes. Thank you.
This is East End Inc. We heard University of Southampton UK professor and author Philip Hoare discussing his latest work, Albert and the Whale, Albrecht Dürer, and How Art Imagines Our World. The book was published in 2021 by Pegasus Books, New York. Other works by Philip Hoare include The Whale, In Search of the Giants of the Sea, published by HarperCollins in 2011, and Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea, from University of Chicago Press in 2018. Upcoming events produced by the Canio's Cultural Cafe include the 2021 Moby Dick Marathon, to be held September 10th through 12th at locations throughout Sag Harbor. More events are online at the calendar of events at canios.wordpress.com.
East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Canio's Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soker.